Hey there, I'm so glad you're here. My name is Margaret Petrie, and this is Authentic Obsessions. The world is filled with prolific artists who have an obsessive hunger to create. Today I'm talking with Lori Pearsall, who's an expat living in Spain. I gotta tell ya, I love this community so much. The love and support and connections are so generous and heartfelt. I should have done this years ago. So I met Lori through Paula DeStefanis, who was my very first guest on this podcast. Lori is a voracious learner and passionate educator who uses the narratives from her own experience to connect with others. She promotes dialogue about identity within the framework of mental health and trauma recovery. The impact she's making by sharing her work is so important. She also educates adolescents in the development of emotional intelligence and self-expression through the arts. Check out the show notes for links to Lori's Instagram and website. You can also find links on her episode page at AuthenticObsessions.com. So you know I want you to follow me on Instagram at Authentic Obsessions, but really what I want more than that is for you to share the podcast, because it's not about me, it's about community and sharing the stories and experiences of all the artists. I just think it's so important for us to listen to other creatives while they embrace the uncertainty that fuels their work. None of us are alone. So if you like this episode, if it resonates with you, and if you think someone else would appreciate it, please share it with your friends. And please subscribe and leave a review, because that's how more people will find us. All right, without further ado, here's my conversation with Lori Pearsall. Hey, Lori, I'm so glad to have you on the podcast today. I'm so grateful to Paula for connecting us.
Well, thanks. I was thrilled that Paula reached out to me and told me about your program, and I've been listening, and I've been so excited this week to get a chance to talk to you and come out of my cocoon here on the island and talk about creativity with you. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Tell us where you are.
I am on the island of Mallorca, which is off the peninsula of Spain, the mainland of Spain. And I am originally from Massachusetts, witch burning zone north of Boston. And I've been here for 16 years living as an expat and an artist.
Excellent. Well, let's start off. I want to hear about your creative path. Tell us whatever you want to tell us.
Yeah, it's an easy answer because I grew up in a family of makers, creators, inventors. It's just always been part of my life. My dad's an engineer. My mom's domestic goddess mastermind of a household of seven children, handmade all her clothes, amazing chef, crafter. She did not go to art school, but wanted to. My grandfather's an inventor. So there's just, it was like the Industrial Revolution and the homesteaders kind of in a mashup. That's what like my home was like. So everyone in my family, we all make. Not all of us went to art school. A couple of us did. And so the youngest three kids ended up in New York City at the same time, one for acting and my brother Al and I for art. So I had an amazing art teacher in high school who guided me and all of my siblings, in fact. So I went to the Cooper Union in New York City. It was from a really small town, and I went to New York. I studied painting there, but I've always been a voracious learner. So I took every free course I possibly could at Parsons or NYU or anywhere. I squeezed myself in to study set design as well, and sociology and psychology, because I knew I wanted to be an educator. And then I got my master's in Boston at the Mass College of Art, and I did a double master's focused on painting. And then I simultaneously was getting my teaching certificate. And I did all of that while I was already starting to teach. So I've been teaching for 30 years already, believe it or not.
Wow.
I've been in just absolutely immersed in fine art, especially, and in secondary arts education, primarily for over 30 years now.
When did you first make something that you loved?
It is really tricky to answer that. I'm going to just be very authentic and tell you what just came into my mindscape. So I was obsessed with my little fake fur mice that were made with rabbit fur, if anyone knows of those.
Uh-huh.
So my mother used to hide them in the knots of the wood in the wainscoting in the house, because she's amazing. I would steal them and sew my own clothes for them. And I had like my mouse universe. So I was the youngest of seven. So, you know, I needed some friends of my own, right? Pecking uh-huh. order. you know, sometimes I used to make their homes. And so I remember, and a lot of my artwork actually to this day is about moving and packing and homes and boxes and things. So it's interesting that this came to mind. But I remember taking an empty tissue box with the oval hole in it. I rigged it up into an elevator and my mice like went from like country mouse to city mouse. Like I was like, you guys, you know.
That's wonderful.
Getting good in Mouseville. So I just remember being really proud of myself. I was probably 8. I don't know. I mean, I was making things before that, but I remember just being like, my mouse house is rocking.
That's a great story. Tell us about your obsessions. I want to hear about what you make, but I think we should talk about your obsession first.
Okay. Yeah, I think storytelling was really the first thing that came to mind thinking about the obsession that really touches on everything I do, not just in terms of what happens in the studio. Because storytelling, for me, it really is about community and understanding people. I'm also a meditation and yoga instructor. Self-expression is the key to storytelling. It's hearing everyone's individual stories and finding out what we have in common through those unique one-of-a-kind stories. So it's fundamental to my work as a teacher. It's also my own personal journey. I'm always learning and changing, and telling my own story has been important in that. I've had a lot of an unfortunate amount of adversity and a few pretty significant traumas in my life. Actually not telling my story was really, really hindering my self-expression for a few decades, actually. And it wasn't until a handful of years ago that I realized I was working overtime on getting everyone else to tell me their stories and being a conduit to supporting other people to share their stories, discover themselves, you know, work on their self-expression through art or through writing, through yoga or meditation practice. And then, yeah, it started to become really clear to me that I had some of my own storytelling to do. So the narrative piece comes into my visual work as well. We can get up into the physical aspect of that later, but you'll see from my work, I'm not a painter or a designer or a set designer or a sculptor. I don't care what the medium is. It starts with the story, always.
Talk a little bit about what we leave behind and what we take with us when we're trying to find home. I'm interpreting that as not only literal, but also figuratively?
Yes, it is. It is definitely both. I started playing with that question as a secondary educator in Massachusetts, and I used to do this thing called Art All State, which was this intensive weekend. I think it was in Rhode Island School of Design or something. I have a bit of a Tasmanian devil workaholic CV, if you've looked at it. So I can't really remember everything all the time. So I always found it was a great prompt for students, because I wasn't really interested in just teaching someone kind of how to draw a vase of flowers. With all due respect to all the flower painters in the world, I love them. But for me, I really want to get to know young people. And that was always kind of the superior motive to teaching them how to draw, paint, print, whatever. That's technical. We can get there. I wanted them to get right in touch with the thematic associations that are important to them. So that always drives my teaching. And I started with that question, you know, to get them going. So flash forward to 2009, 2010, I was, after moving to Mallorca, I immersed myself into a series on the ruined architecture and homes being torn down here on the island, which left these exposed facades. And I was really fascinated by it. At the same time, my parents had to sell my childhood home. I was trying to find my way as a fish out of water in a new place. The marriage I came here in was ending. So I was also in this massive state of flux and preparing to move again. So I began a project called Moving Stories. And I just sent out a call. I think it was on my blog, one of my blogs at the time. I sent out a call for people to send me their moving stories. And that was one of the key questions. What will you take with you and what do you leave behind? And I got loads of responses from familiar, close people, strangers. And it really is about the objects. You know, I mean, I'm an object person. I love to study a thing. So it's about kind of those precious objects, ephemera, which is kind of our personal, those less permanent items and things that forensically kind of tell our story, but then definitely also that figurative and kind of metaphysical sense as well. Because I think every time we move from a home, there's a reason for it. So that's pretty loaded. Sometimes it's a happy reason. Sometimes it's a devastating reason. Sometimes it's pragmatic. So that's interesting. But also the sense of place. Are you running away from something? Are you running to something? What are your aspirations for that new place? There's something in that liminal space, and then reestablishing yourself and finding home in a new place. So, I mean, it's a pretty big topic, really. And I've moved 23, 25 times since I was 18. So, yeah, I think about it a lot. My responses when I did that call out have, I mean, amazing. And I wrote people's stories actually into my paintings. I was working abstractly at the time in any language. So their stories were literally physically immersed in the layers of collage and assemblage of the pieces.
So when you pose that question to your students, they're what, 15, 16?
Yeah, the bulk of them, yeah, upper high school.
Somewhere in there, okay. Yeah. So what comes up for them? I can think of many things that I leave behind and take with us when we move around. But if someone's lived in the same place the whole time, are they thinking about leaving home? Or maybe they just talk about times that they've moved in their life? I'm curious.
I think what struck me at the time when I did that was how similar the answers were to the adults. A lot of people choose photos. A lot of people say nothing as long as I'm safe. Right. You know, just want to get out safe. You know, if it's like a fire or something, you know, right. They imagine it has to be a catastrophe. Some people will list a pet. So those are some of the standard answers. Some of them might maybe say like an item of jewelry or something. Oh, like my dad gave me this thing or this trophy I won. So, but some of the most poignant answers were from children of divorce. And that was really powerful to me at the time because I was just beginning the process of divorce in 2009, 2010. So it was like, wow, you know, and my daughter is now 16, was five at the time. So needless to say, it was a pretty poignant moment. And to hear those kids talk about having to straddle two homes and, you know, the favorite chair or things that they love about one home and how do you divide that? And it's an ongoing discussion that I have with my daughter today. You know, we speak very openly about it. So that was something I found interesting. It was as though those 16, 17 year olds were so happy someone asked them that question.
Right.
They said, I'll tell you. Like, I'm kind of pissed that I don't have my favorite whatever, or, you know.
Right. They got to process this in a way they never thought they would in an art class.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the invitation.
Right.
If someone wants to take it, you know, some people are like, it's a bit personal. I'm not going to go there. And that's fine.
But you leave that open to them if they're willing and ready and wanting to do that. So tell us a little bit about what you make, which I know is also a complicated question. We'll show pictures on the episode page. You really, really have to go look there. You have to follow Lori on Instagram and look at her website because this is incredible work. I only wish I could see it in person. So tell us.
So, well, what folks will see if they go to the Auto Ephemera website, all of that work, believe it or not, is within the last 5 years. There is an archive page, you know, one of the tabs where you can go back and look. And you will think that there are many Lauries running around because my work has taken so many different forms. As I said, it starts with the story and then the materials will speak to me. The work that you're seeing, the body of work there now, is very much about storytelling. And I'm using my own journals. And a lot of those recent pieces are actually my own. I've been journaling since I could draw, since I was about four, but really very religiously and almost daily since I was about 16. Some of the pieces are actually the actual one-of-a-kind torn-up pages from my journals. There are some other pieces where I have some typed text or text from books that I have deconstructed and then given new form into garments. That's the series that is most prevalent on the website, and you'll also see drawings and paintings as well. And that particular body of work is dealing with, some of it very directly dealing with essentially coming out of the closet as someone who has experienced a potpourri of assaults and a rape as well. I decided after reading a great article about a new book that's come out of not using the term, survivor or victim so much. So I decided to say, I've experienced this. I'm going to try that on for size. So basically, my daughter coming out of puberty and starting to face adolescence, when I realized that I had definitely had some unfinished business. My work is very autobiographical, whether it's literal and you can read my journal words or it's an abstraction. My work is, it's very anatomical. And I mean that in a figurative sense. It's very much about deconstructing what's going on for me. The imagery itself generally comes from dreams or meditation. So I extract the visuals directly from that kind of semi-conscious state where I think is where I need to put my trust because it's the most interesting. Otherwise, I'll do something I've seen on Instagram and not realize it. Whoops. So, we all want to be as authentic as possible. So the pieces themselves and the ideas for the structure of these garments and these pieces came either from dreams, the visualization process, and also just the material speaking to me. I try to use almost 100% recycled materials always. I confess to buying a bit of paint and glue now and then, and I need my wire cutters, but so recycled materials, anything I can find, those will speak to me and I'll gather something and it'll stay in the studio. And then suddenly the installation or the piece will begin to take form.
I'm looking at something in the background, a coat, a robe.
It's a bathrobe.
So I'm looking at a bathrobe. Is there a wire form under there? It looks stiff to me. Can you explain a little bit how you put that together?
Yeah. It's completely made out of paper and it is stuffed with shredded impact statements. So this piece was born of my, borrow the term, coming out in terms of writing my own impact statement as someone who experienced rape and assault. I was inspired by Chanel Miller's her name, the Stanford case. If she were to listen to this, I would like to say thank you to her. Who wrote really a very powerful impact statement, and I realized I never had. So I started to make this piece during the Kavanaugh hearings, and I started to make a whole series of work at that time. I was very influenced in this piece. You'll see the blacked out redacted chunks. I was getting increasingly irritated by what I was seeing in some political imagery that they were releasing documents, but then, 79% of it was redacted. And I thought, okay, how about I redact my statement? And so I wrote my own impact statement. And then I went through this process of redacting the things that I still felt shame about. And it was a really interesting process. On the website, you'll see that I filmed the statement coming out of the printer. And then I went back and highlighted the stuff that I wanted people to read. And I did a show, and I had never really told anyone this story. And I did a show where I hung down the corridor every page of my impact statement. And then I lay the bathrobe on the floor because the story ends with me waking up in a barn, abandoned in a barn. That's the true story. I didn't plan on making the bathrobe. It was something that purely happened intuitively. And I realized after making it, I wished someone had washed me up and wrapped me in a warm robe and I was held that morning. I actually did a Brooklyn sketchbook project about the making of this piece. And it's just laying on the floor. Originally, I thought, oh, it's going to be on the wall and I'll light it from the inside. Like I've transcended blah, blah, blah. But when I brought it to the gallery, I just laid it on the floor and I thought, well, no, this is the impact. It is a very sad piece. And that's okay. It's okay. It's okay to feel sad for this young woman. Yeah, so it's all made out of paper and my story.
Can you tell our listeners just very briefly what an impact statement is?
Well, an impact statement, I didn't really know what it was until I think it was 2016, 17, perhaps, when I read Chanel Miller's impact statement. It's something that someone who has been victimized of assault or rape writes to prepare for the court process so that they, prosecutor and the defense can understand what the impact of the violence has had on the individual. And it can be like, oh, I had to drop out of school or this and that, or, from very intimate details to actually very practical things, post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something that I actually was living with for years and I didn't really know it because I didn't know what to call it. Mm-hmm. I actually just had never written one. And it took me three or four years, from reading Chanel Miller's to actually sit down and do mine. I hadn't realized how hard it was to sit down. And I just wrote for pages and pages and pages and pages. All of the ways that I felt and all of the different ramifications over time and the ways that it affected my relationships and et cetera.
When people view your work, are there reactions or conversations you hope to spark?
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I had a really busy 2018-19 and I had like 6 or 7 shows in a really short period of time. And this was one of the pieces. I also had another show where I did a bullfighter's cape. I mixed the wolf pack gang rape trial that's well known from Pamplona, Spain, in with my own. So you're the matador and the bull at the same time, right? So. And I remember at that opening, I mean, I'm laughing. It's not funny, but I'm laughing, human nature funny. Because people come up and be like, oh, it's so beautiful. Because I like to make things that are beautiful.
Right.
And they come up and like, ooh, it's so beautiful. And then they read the little blurb or they get a little closer and read it. And then the face changes. And it's like, ooh. Some people start crying. Some people come up to me and just say, thank you. Thank you. And some people look at each other, whisper under their breath, and get as far away as possible. So there's a mix. In the studio, when I have a studio visit, one thing I find is fascinating is a lot of women in particular, that's really the main example I have, will say, oh, it's so interesting that you're making work about this because, I was raped or I was assaulted, but it never really bothered me or it didn't have a big effect on my life. Or they might make a comment about the hashtag MeToo movement and how the anger's a bit much. Okay, with all due respect, okay, this is a common response. And then literally without taking a breath, they will spill their guts to me. Oh. And then after I say, see, that's what the MeToo thing does right there. Thank you for telling me. They're literally telling me their impact statement. And then they'll go, I don't know what just happened. I've never told anyone that before. And it's happened to me many, many times. Oh. And I hold those stories just really preciously. And I know it's not everybody's game to share their, their personal work. Putting the bathrobe piece, for example, out there was excruciating for me. I'm a jovial person and I love to talk about my work and everything, but these were some sad ass pieces, and
from a distance, they don't look sad.
That's a little bit
right.
Part of the trick as well, because I've done a really great job of hiding my trauma over the years. And that's also what that series on my website that you will see is about. That's why they're garments. Mm-hmm. I did an amazing job of appearing well-balanced and totally together on the outside. There was another story to be told, and that's what this work really is about.
Thank you for sharing it.
You're welcome.
And holding a place for other people to tell their stories, even if it's just to themselves.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a catalyst that someone needs.
Right. And I know it's not for everyone, but I have the capacity and I have the willingness and I have that educator's mind. So.
Right.
I decided, well, I'm going to go for it because I can.
Let's talk a little bit about the physicality of your work. I'm very interested in how your body feels when you're working, after you work, how you recover. You already mentioned you're a yoga instructor, meditation teacher. I'm assuming that plays into it. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'll begin with the ending, as I usually end up in the bath. I'm a bather. I need to be in the bathtub at the end of a kind of a strenuous physical day. The physicality question is actually a really important one for me now, because in the last few years, and particularly since right before our confinement period, I've been through going through a diagnostic process, and I have had to completely change the way I work because I have degenerative disc disease, which is not unusual. A lot of people have it in the lumbar, but I actually have it all through my cervical spine and my lumbar. To simplify it without getting into, you know, medical details, the orthopedic surgeon told me I have a 70-year-old spine and I'm 50. So, but I had to go through that process because I was in pain all the time. So the knock-on effect arthritis has really changed my life in recent years. So I went from working in the theater, I'm strong, I lift weights, I'm like a kind of like a brute, you know, I'm really physical, tomboy, you know, just love the physicality of working. So I have, you know, electrical tools, I've always built my own frames, I cast things in plaster and clay. My work has always been very heavy, actually physically very heavy, the work leading up to about 3 to 5 years ago. I can't do it anymore. I don't want to, but it also, I have some limitations now that I need to respect. So moving into the paper pieces has been a really fun way. And I didn't plan for it, but the timing of it is just right because I can carry these. They're still cumbersome and I have nowhere to store them, but that's another story. I can carry them very easily. I carry them like you'd carry kind of like, you know, like a little
frail
or a granny. I always think right. Big, you know,
right, so right.
It's like, hey, honey, let's get you into bed, you know. But I am doing a lot more writing. I've always been a bit of a closet writer. Writing has always been part of my creative process, but I'm finding I'm doing a lot more writing now. I've written poetry forever, but I don't share it very much. So I'm starting to work with my writing, and I think using the journal pieces and using the impact statement, for example, has been a way for me to find a new way of working that is not so physically taxing on my body. So yes, I start every day in the mountains walking. I meditate every day. I do my physical therapy and my yoga. And I have to do a lot for pain management, but it's good that way because it keeps me from sitting in one place too long. Often after a long day in the studio, or if I've set up an installation or taken one down, you're definitely ending up in the bath with the lavender oil and like, oh yeah, I'm a bather.
Let's talk about your studio space and your workspace a little bit. Can you describe it for us?
I've lived in a lot of places, so my studio is wherever I am. If I don't have a big one, which I don't at the moment, I have had some really pretty glorious, wonderful spaces over the years. But I'm in one of the bedrooms in my home now, and it's mostly filled with my pieces. So it ends up kind of more being a planning space, and then I work in every other room of the house. I'm a very patient partner and daughter. So depending on the season, because I live in a hot climate, so depending on the season, I will drag some bits down and work out in the patio and the terrace outside. Or if I'm doing something that needs hand stitching, I will work on the dining room table. If I'm, you know, jerry rigging an antique that I want to upcycle and refinish, I'll probably sit on the floor in here and do it. So I work wherever. I generally have to clean up after myself because I have taken over the house. It looks like a craft bomb went off, or like an old AC Moore exploded when I'm in the middle of something. If my studio's clean, it means I'm incubating a new project.
Is there something in your studio that you can't live without?
Yes. It is a little illustration of my brother Alan, who's one of my mentors. Every studio I've ever had, this half self-portrait of my brother ends up in. He was house-sitting for me. I used to live in Ipswich, Massachusetts, and so did he, and I was on vacation or something, and he was feeding my cats, and he went in. I had painted murals on the walls, and he took a pencil and drew little cartoon creatures all around the mural. Only a sibling can put up with that kind of thing. He went in my studio and he did this little portrait, and it's a half portrait of him on the easel, and it said, "Get to work."
Oh.
That is in every studio because, you know, we can all make up excuses and reasons not to work. And it's like, you know what, just shut up, just get to work.
What do you do when you get stuck?
Well, I've been at it for a long time, and I've gotten much, much better at working through those periods. You know, there was a time when I was really stuck, and I would do daily painting. You know, I'd just set up a task, and I think it was, is it Ben Seaman? I think you had another chat, and I appreciated that conversation, because it's something I would recommend to any student or anyone who, if you're just stuck, just set up a little project for a month or whatever, or 30 minutes a day, an hour, whatever you want to do, and just do it. No questions asked. So I'll do daily painting if necessary. I actually have too many ideas, which is kind of, it's a blessing and a curse.
Yes.
Because I'm just a voracious, sensual beast, basically. So, I mean, I can smell something on a walk in the morning and then design an entire like music video production based on that smell. So my problem is selectivity, not creative block. If that makes sense.
But it does make sense.
Kind of like,
absolutely.
Well, I'll go through an old sketchbook. That helps a lot because sketchbooks are visual journals. So I'll go through an old sketchbook and then I'm like, oh yeah, 17 years ago, I had this really cool idea and it's still relevant somehow. Why don't I tinker with that?
So how do you choose when you have so many things to select from?
Yeah, it's taken me a lot of time to figure that one out. And I would never say I've wasted time, but I've done a lot of spinning of my wheels in the mud and spending a lot of time like in a rabbit hole researching something or sketching something a million times and then ending up not using it. And I mean, it's all good in the end, you know, you've got to do something some days, you know, so drawing is always great. But there are times when I think, wow, it's really off the mark. So what I do now, just had a real sense of clarity, my physical limitations and this newfound ability to tell my own story more succinctly, I guess, in recent years has helped me. So I actually go back to that narrative that I talked about, that my work is always thematic, essentially. Mm-hmm. So if it's the selectivity, I have to catch myself if I'm responding to an inspiration or just reacting. So, and here's where we get into meditation and this.
Yes.
Because I get excited about things, right? I get like, oh, this is so great. And, you know, now I'm going to be a drag queen, you know, like, you know, because I love Halloween, so I'm making costumes and yeah. And I kind of can run away with an idea. I've learned to discern whether that's me just being reactive and liking something, or maybe even on the converse, avoiding something that's hard. So I'm trying now to be responsive, and that's where meditation and things come through. So I just go back to what are my goals? I am a super personal mastery nerd. I set goals every year. I check them quarterly. I am a very purpose-driven person. So what do I want to make my work about? How can I best be of service to other people? So I have a few themes. And then I'll even mind map if I have to. I know this is like Nerdville Central for some people and it's not for everybody, but it's what works for me. So if I can kind of catch myself, if I'm just on a hyperactive, reactive, just enthusiastic day, and I start to go off on a tangent and I think, wait a minute, is that serving my purpose? Is that serving the story that I'm trying to tell? That kind of narrative literary piece actually really does help to anchor me. Because ultimately, I'm trying to reach people. I'm not trying to be cryptic. And I want the work to be fun, if possible, and at the very least beautiful, because some of my work is funny. Some of it is dark. Some of it's enigmatic. Fine. But I would like people to take pleasure looking at it because I'm a craftsperson as well. I just try to reel myself in a little bit. I've gotten better as I'm maturing in recognizing when I'm just kind of like excited about something.
Right.
Doesn't mean I need to change my project.
I find myself sitting with something for a day, 2 days, a week, just thinking about it before I'm acting. It's easier to do that, I think, as I get older for me. So just being present with the idea and thinking through not just the first day of excitement and enthusiasm of what it's going to feel like, but what it's going to feel like on day 10, what's the end result? That's growth for me, I guess. And meditation totally has helped me with that.
Yeah.
Seeped into the rest of my life.
My work very labor intensive as well. If I'm going to hand stitch 750 tickets onto something, I better really be married to the concept. Otherwise, then it feels like drudgery, and that's
right.
Okay. Boring moments in our work, you know, not all of it is glamorous, but if I'm going to abandon it, that's not a good sign at all.
Right. As an educator and an artist, I'm wondering if you have a uniform when you're in the studio.
So when I'm at home, because as an educator, I do most of my work, you know, on the weekends, the vacations and things like that. I'm generally in a tank top and leggings, whatever I've walked in or exercised in or something, or like my new yoga clothes. And then I start working and then they have paint on them. Those become my painting clothes. So they have like three stages of grunge with my, anything with spandex in it. That's what I'm in. I need to be able to move mm-hmm. easily in my mm-hmm. studio. However, I started teaching so young that I actually dress up for work, even though you don't have to in Spain. They use your first name, everyone wears jeans. I do like to dress up, you know, I like a bit to throw some lipstick on. So I have this kind of like work attire, because you know I also meet with parents and do that kind of stuff, and
right.
I think I had to set myself apart from students because I started teaching so young, and it was just easier to just create a visual distinction because I'm very youthful in my behavior and my language and stuff sometimes, so that helps. And I really love to dress up, so I always am overdressed at art openings because I'm not in New York City anymore, so it's kind of with all sorry Palma, but it's not fun here sometimes because everyone's so casual. And I'm like, time to bring out the vintage jacket. And yeah. I actually really like to glam it up, but in the studio, I'm just, you know, about being on my hands and knees, and there's usually blood involved.
And no, bandages. Seriously.
Well, yeah, I'm staple gunning. I mean, I'm building, I'm ripping, right. cutting. Yeah.
That's a great visual. How do you cultivate rest and play? Do you have time for that?
Yeah, I make time. I'm uber organized. As an educator, it works. You know, we live by the minute on the school clock. So that's always been part of my life. I'm really working hard now at doing even less. I'm trying to cut down the number of things I'm doing by 2/3 right now, because I'm trying to move more slowly, more meditatively, fewer better things. So I'm actually spending more time walking in the mountains. Anytime I'm feeling a little strange in the studio, or, you know, maybe some personal stress is creeping in, I go right to the meditation mat. That's one of the things that the quarantine has been good for, is I've been able to do that. To have quiet time. I build it in because it's absolutely necessary for me. I have to get 8 hours of sleep at night. I've always been like that because I'm a voracious person while I'm awake, and I'm kind of an all-day person, so I do need to be quiet. I'm an ambivert, so I'm really on when I'm teaching or when I need to be of service to other people, but I very much like to be alone. A lot of people don't know that about me. I really like the other humans to go away sometimes so that I can just be with my mind palace and process and think and reflect.
What's the hardest thing about your work that people might not expect?
I was very fortunate in that my mentor, my teacher in secondary school, and I actually worked alongside him for 14 years. I went back and taught at my old high school. So he is a designer and a photographer. And so although I would be categorized as a fine artist, I was taught by someone who taught us in secondary school how to package your work, how to photograph it, cleaning up the edges, all of that. So I've always been okay with that part of it. I photograph every day that I work, so I always have process shots on hand. I do my own website. I do all of my own promotional work. My brother's a graphic designer, so I was kind of, you know, inspired by him to be like, just figure it out, do it yourself. So for the actual artwork itself, I would say the selectivity, because I do have a lot of layers of meaning in my piece, and it does happen to me sometimes where people are like, this is so cool. Well, what is it? We don't get it, right? What is it about? Because my work takes, you have to look at it for a minute. There are different layers of meaning. So there's that kind of selectivity and making sure that I'm really communicating an idea sufficiently. That's important to me. I don't want it to only be aesthetically pleasing. It's important for me that there is a communication going on between the viewer and the piece. That's something I always have to watch out for. I find time is the biggest thing. I've worked full-time my whole life, and I am very productive. I'm in the studio a lot, but I find the, you know, the social media and the promotion, I am exhibiting and stuff, but wow, I'm tired sometimes because it's that piece of it is, it does take a lot of time. You know, I'd love to have a personal assistant, and maybe I will at some point, to help me take care of the business side of it. I can do it myself, and I do, but something always suffers, you know, so maybe it's keeping up my web presence, for example.
Right. Can you talk more about your relationship with social media?
I really enjoyed blogging when that was kind of a thing when I first moved here. I'm actually about to launch a new blog on the Auto Ephemera website. I like Instagram because you can curate it yourself. I'm not worried about being on it all day because I'm busy. Like, I can't just be online all day. And then I'll start looking at cat videos. And I'm not using that just as a catchphrase. Like, I'm obsessed with cats, so it's a real risk. I learned something from Tim Ferriss years ago about being on an information diet. So just as like, I'm not going to, you know, bring Doritos into the home, I am very careful about how much social media I consume because it is a brain sucker and a time sucker. Yeah, I'm really disciplined. So I have a certain amount of time in the morning, like maybe with my coffee or whatever, where I'd like check Instagram, scroll some stuff. I do try to follow new people every week, connect with someone every week. I will cold call people, you know, just contact someone randomly and say, hey, you know, I think your work is great, or da da da, or chase down a new gallery. I really try to use it practically because otherwise it actually can be a little bit toxic. I have a 16-year-old, so it's really interesting to watch the territory that she's navigating in terms of, on the positive end, actually, you know, learning about activism in the new ways that it's taking form as we speak, but also the, you know, the kind of cyberbullying and all the imagery that is inundation of imagery. So I'm very cautious with it, I have to say. I do think I can do a better job at finding some community in the artists out there. And that's one of the reasons I was really happy to talk to you today, because that's where I think I could dedicate some energy.
I'm going to switch tacks here a little bit. I keep staring at this bathrobe in the background, and I'm thinking about your exhibits and the sizes of the pieces and how it's not just a painting you can put on the wall. I'm assuming all of your work is for sale, or is it?
More or less.
So talk a little bit about your audience.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're speaking about commercial audience.
Right.
Essentially, I mean, in part there. So this was a real conscious choice, actually, because I think for decades, the intent or the hope of making work that was commercially viable or sellable or attractive to a gallery who wants you to have a very succinct body of work or message. That was something that it took me literally decades to figure this out, that it was actually really crippling to me because my work was really about community outreach. Now, as soon as I stopped caring that I was going to sell anything, my creativity just went,
wow.
I decided
that's so interesting.
I did not need to care because you know what? I wasn't getting rich yet. So
right, like, right.
Okay, I do illustrate and I paint as well, and I can make high quality prints of those and sell them. Fine, I can do that. But what I use my pieces for, I don't think someone's going to put it in their house. They're not archival. These things are made of paper, these recent things. Some of them are not. Some of them are made of antiques and stuff. Some of them are fragile. What these pieces are designed for is for conversation. So I bring them to schools and then we talk about bullying. So mm-hmm. I really like non-conventional display spaces. So I will show in the town hall, in the abandoned church, in the library. I will take my pieces to other secondary schools on the island, and I will have the students look at a piece. I might give them some prompt questions. I won't tell them anything about me or their work. And then we'll talk about sexual assault, or we'll talk about bullying. For me, they are a means to communicating and to first outreach. Are they aesthetically like, in, you know, yeah, like we all want to look at something delicious and interesting and be like, oh, how long did it take you to make that? You know, I mean, I get all those questions and stuff too. But do I want to, you know, sell one of my pieces for lots of money to a gallery? Yeah, hey, you know, give me a call, of course. But that can't be my underlying motivation. It's just not enough for me. And I have some pieces that they are made out of my journals, and they are chock full of juicy little personal nuggets. So the prices are very high for those.
Yeah, that'd be hard to part with.
I would part with it for a price. And I'd have to give them like a magnifying glass. And I actually literally, this is a true story. I actually eliminated a few names. I studied the pieces very carefully to make sure the names and identities of people in my past or people that I care about are not easily identified, or I glued over it or something. It sounds really crazy because it takes time to do that, but I'm that meticulous.
Oh, that doesn't sound crazy at all.
I'm not here to call anyone else out.
Right, right.
It's really, you know, I really try to respect people's privacy.
Thank you for sharing all of that. Tell me about your support system when things get tough. Who do you go to?
So I'm an expat, and that definitely has its challenges. There are expat communities here, and there are artists here, and I have, you know, met and found people. But I find my kind of tribe of people to reach out to is much more of a constellation than it is a congregation. So I have people kind of all over the planet, if that makes sense.
So, love it.
You know that question they ask of like, what would your ideal dinner party be? Well, I think of that like pretty much every week because I miss my people sometimes because they're all over the place. They're not all in the same island, you know?
Right. So
I have people here on the island that I care about and stuff. But when you're an expat, my experience has been that as much as I do have some dear friends here, they had their life, their childhood friends all established here, and I left mine. So you don't just slip in that easily. And also, I'm a little extra sometimes, so I don't know if I fit in very neatly to some of the circles anyway. My best girlfriend, literally of 50 years, my whole childhood, you know, like she's a go-to person. I have an amazing friend that I met, one of my very first people that I met here, and our kids kind of grew up together, who has now repatriated to England. She's amazing. My mom, you know, we're very different women, but we're really connected, and I speak to her a lot, and she just listens to all my weird stories, you know. She's always like, oh, you're always up to something, you know, because I'm like, okay, and then I'm going to have like this helium balloon. And, you know, I'm explaining this thing that makes absolutely no sense that came from a dream. And she's just like, I'm sure you're going to do a great job.
Oh, unconditional love.
It's perfect. It's great. Yeah, but I do have a very handy tool. When you use the word tool, the first thing that came to mind is I read and listen to a lot of material dedicated to the creative process. So I'm always studying Eckhart Tolle, Deepak Chopra, Elizabeth Gilbert, Tim Ferriss, Brené Brown, all our people. Those are my people. You know, I really appreciate people who understand the direct link between making the search for self and authenticity. I mean, that's what the process is about. So when I lose my way a little bit, or so whether it's for a personal issue or it's about just whatever I'm cobbling up in the studio, I know that there are timeless teachings out there that I can go to and get quiet. So I really do have a set of tools that I use. I'm still wishing for that fantasy dinner party. So maybe when they get a vaccine, I can, you know, we can set that up.
Who would you invite?
Oh, okay. Can we do the alive or dead thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Because what we're going to do is we're going to get a time travel machine because Mindy Sue Wittick is going to use her financial windfall to produce a time travel machine. So,
okay, I get it. So we're merging.
Perfect. Right, right, right.
Okay. So, well, Wendy, she's my, you know, my lifelong friend, whole life. She gets my work better than anyone else. Yeah, definitely. My friend Miranda that I already mentioned. I definitely want Mr. Dead from the Monty Python, you know, when he comes in at the end, all the salmon mousse, just to remind everyone, you know, hey, this is all about impermanence. You never know. Okay. To have the comedy factor and the visual reminder, I think is important. And Eckhart Tolle would be great. Russell Brand and his newest amalgamation as a pro recovery, amazing guy who's helping people together with folks like Gabor Mate, you know, get real about people's experiences and having great conversations about that. I need someone to sing because I really can't sing. So I don't know, like, why don't we bring Katie Lang or someone in, you know?
There you go.
Gaga. Like, I mean, I'm aiming high. Like, I want Oprah, Gaga, like, bring them in. Let's do this. And I love to cook. So for me, it would be just an absolute gift not to be the chatterbox that I can be and to just cook for everybody and make gorgeous food for everybody and then watch them all talk. Mr. Dead's little bony finger pointing at everyone.
And I hope you live stream that so we can all watch.
That was a really weird segue, but thank you for letting me be authentic.
Yeah, sir. Why not? All right. Here, let's go to something else. What are you aching to change in the world or in yourself?
Well, I've started in myself already. Got a head start so that I'd be better at talking about it. I think mental health support and therapy, counseling of all different forms have to be as common as going to the dentist. I'm just so tired of everybody needing so much help. And I don't even want anyone to say anymore, well, do you think you should talk to someone? I'm like, what do you mean? My neighbor or the mailman? No. Who is someone? Say the word. Therapist, counselor, psychotherapist. It's gotten better. It's getting better. But everybody needs support, particularly coming from the yoga community as well. It cannot only happen in the realm of the metaphysical and these kind of this magical hope of intention setting. We can do all of that. But you need to understand how the mind works as well. So you need professionals who study the body and mind to come together. And working with adolescents, I could stop teaching art tomorrow and just teach emotional intelligence, and I'd be just as satisfied because everybody needs to be able to work through their stuff. Keeping secrets does not work. I feel very strongly about that.
No, I wholeheartedly agree. Do you think it's more of an accessibility issue now? People are more understanding about it. They understand that there's a need. It's not mm-hmm. a need-based issue. It's an accessibility issue, or people are.
Both. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's both.
It feels like we talk about it a lot more than we used to.
And that's fabulous. Yeah. Working with adolescents. I mean, they are the upcoming generation. So I would say less shame, but yes, it cannot be an elite thing. It cannot.
Absolutely.
Be so expensive. I see a psychotherapist twice a week. And I decided a few years ago that I would say to my mom, oh no, I can't talk to you at 5 because I have therapy. Like, why am I pretending like it's a thing that I need to, like, and I'm not saying that everybody needs to be, you know, people are more, have different degrees of their, you know, protecting their privacy. It's not really what I'm getting at here. It does need to be more accessible. It is actually really critical that we're helping and supporting them to understand the undercurrent of emotional processes that they're going through at all the phases of their life. And at any time, I think everybody could use some supportive coaching, support, therapy, counseling, intensive psychotherapy, trauma recovery. So yeah, I feel very strongly about that. And that's why I decided to change tack a bit in the purpose and the service of my work in recent years.
Again, thank you for sharing that. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about you, your work, the world?
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking a little bit about the creative process and learning, you know, because one of my other obsessions is learning. As a teacher, like I said, I started teaching when I was 19. It was for a program that you were supposed to be 20 to start. And I went up and I was like, you know, you don't get it. Like, this is what I'm born to do. So I need to be here. I've always had the kind of the vocation of teaching. I knew I wanted to teach before I knew I wanted to be, whether it was going to be art or literature or writing, I wasn't quite sure. I was just super insecure with both. So, but there's something about the learning process, and I'm still hooked. Thankfully, artists don't have textbooks. I recreate my lesson plans every year because I just am always trying to learn a new way to teach creativity. And I teach because of the transferable skills, not because I'm looking to create mini-me's that are going to go off to art school. Let's be real. A fraction of my students will study an art-related profession, but the success stories of all my previous students and so many friends really have come from the transferable skills in studying creative processes and art education. I guess if I were to just throw a message out there, that's something that is really where my focus is. I can teach someone how to make paper mache and how to cast plaster and, you know, to shade better. We can get into that practical realm of mastery, right? That's fine. But it's really about resilience, creative problem solving, being able to argue a point, to look at something from a different point of view, to take negative criticism, to give challenging criticism. There's so many things in an art education and through the learning of creativity that I think will just make everyone better and healthier. That's why I always find it peculiar when we're facing economic recession that the first thing people want to trim is arts education. I coach my students on the chat to have with mom and dad or their guardians, whatever the case may be, if they're having a hard time with them being a creative. I say, don't actually do this, but fantasize an argument where you slowly take everything in the room and you throw it out the window because artists touch everything. And if mom and dad don't get that, you have the whole house destroyed. There's no house, there's no books, there's no candlestick, there's no brooch, there's no garlic press, like whatever. Everything around you was touched by an artist. Artists are the ones who tell our story. Everything. So my students are like, I'm going to go. I'm like, no, don't start a fight. Don't throw anything out the window. I'm just making a point. But you need to let mom and dad understand how broad creative education can be and how critical it is to living a full life and, you know, not living in a little lane, everyone in their lane. I'm telling you, not the house gets emptied and then actually we have to dismantle the house and the garden because a landscape architect did that.
I know that intuitively and subconsciously, but I've never thought about it in such a direct manner before. That's wonderful. I'm looking at everything around me in a different way right now.
Yeah, it's come from having to help students who have to like confess to mom and dad that they might want to get into art therapy or they might want to go for a design degree or something. And it's kind of like, hey, no, this isn't about you just being a wild child. I mean, that's just a simple way to look at it.
And what's wrong with that when we have to say student wants to confess that they want to go into art?
It's bringing the joy and the vitality back into advocating for arts careers or anything remotely kind of linked. That's why it's really wonderful actually today to see people like Elizabeth Gilbert or, you know, there's so many names we can throw out there who are working in business environments to teach them how to be creative. It sounds really like ridiculous to someone who lives in a creative world, but it's so refreshing. It's so great to see how people like Marie Forleo, how approaching business from this really holistic point of view. It's great. Everyone has
it's good for everyone.
That's what I think of authenticity. It's the way we connect and the way we bring ourselves to the table. And as an educator and as a creator, I mean, that's the journey. And so whether it's something that's, you know, design-based or craft-based, or if you're a deep diver like myself, I'm all about narrative and stories and layers, whatever form it takes, it's just got to be the real thing. Otherwise, it's an imitation game. I don't believe in talent, by the way. So that's like podcast number two.
Okay. Now you got to say something else about that. You can't just leave me hanging.
Oh, come on. It's a teaser. I'll be as succinct as I can. It's actually the first thing I say in the first day of class with my new group of students every year, because they are terrified. They're so afraid of getting something wrong. And even this generation is surprising to me. I'm old enough to be their mom, whatever. And I'm shocked at how many of them still have this really narrow view on what being an artist is or what being good at art is. And there's a talent myth that is still running rampant. And, you know, if their grandmother has praised them, that's fantastic. But it's not just about being able to render realistically. They still have this very, very narrow view. And so I teach everything, very multidisciplinary, very mixed media. If I have a student who's challenged spatially or they're struggling with, you know, with shading or proportion, give them some clay and it's amazing what can happen. If I have a student who is genetically predisposed, you know, I mean, I can consider myself one of those people. I mean, there's art kind of all through the generations on both sides. Fair enough. But it's really about perseverance and hard work. The students who think they can just whistle something off the night before, they may come in with a product that at first glance is glossy and like, you know, accomplished technically, but are they really communicating and expressing themselves? Probably not, because they didn't give themselves a chance to do the critique because they procrastinated and did it at the last minute. So talent, it's just a real slippery term, and it's just not enough, because art making takes a ton of perseverance, loads of patience, and just having being gifted. Okay, you know, I'm very thankful that I work well with my hands, because it's saved my soul many, many times over the years. So I'm not belittling, you know, maybe a predilection for the arts, but it's just not enough to kind of build a career on. I even call it the T word at work, because I'm like, ooh, don't, you know, careful. We're just here to make and create and discover and learn, and that's the focus. Supposedly talented students are actually the most lazy, and they don't learn much because they think they have laurels to rest on. And that's not what life is about. It's a journey, and hard work will get you there every time.
All right. Thanks. Okay. Are you ready for your rapid fire questions?
Oh yeah. Okay.
Okay. First one is music, podcast, audiobook, or silence?
God, you have to ask that to an eclectic person. Anything nonfiction, so podcast or reading, audiobook, but yeah, listening to nonfiction.
What's your comfort food?
Oh, nuts, seeds, berries. I'm a foraging rodent, either in a past life or that's where I'm headed. Fingers crossed. You know, those things to make like an orange with peanut butter and cloves and seeds on it and hang it out for the birds. Like, I always kind of felt a little jealous of the animals because I want that.
Describe your favorite outdoor spot.
In the moment, the Sierra Tramontana, which is the mountain just outside my window here. And I walk up it every day, sometimes twice a day, to visit my sheep friends. Any mountain path. And if there are sheep, even better.
What would you do with a financial windfall?
Okay. So if it was just like a couple thousand, I'd get air conditioning, because then I'd be a lot nicer and I'd be of better service to the other. So today I saw that one of my luxurious dream places in Mallorca is for sale for $4 million. It's the old Hotel Colón, which would mean Columbus, I guess, in English. And it's built in 1910. It has the hydraulic tiles, the high ceilings. I've only been in there once because it was near my daughter's dance studio. So after I paid family debts and supported my people in need, I would buy that. I'd live there. It'd be my studio. I'd have a foundation program because there isn't one on the island for the arts. Shelter, whatever, creative, well-being space. Yeah.
Sign me up.
I'm ready. I just need that windfall. So see what you can do.
We'll do what we can on our end. Tell us where people can find you.
Okay. Well, I'm not so much on Facebook. I have a personal Facebook that my Instagram feeds to, but I'm really mostly using Instagram and my website, which I've kind of completely overhauled since last winter. So it's really very much up to date. It's very newsy. There's lots of information. It is bilingual in Spanish and in English. My website is www.autoephemera.com. And my Instagram is @lauriepearsallartist.com.
There'll be a link in the show notes.
Yeah, those are the two main places to find me, whether it's about the arts or also educational outreach. Very interested in those avenues as well. So I welcome anyone to reach out to me.
I really love the community outreach piece. Like, I know that. I know people make art to reach certain demographics. I know people make art to exhibit museums, but talking about it the way we did today gave me so much more context for the work and the impact that you have on different populations. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. It's empowering for me to have you feed that back to me as well, because I think I was in a trap that many artists are for many years, where I thought making art was about proving myself to be worthy of making art. And that's really just a dog chasing its tail. So that'd be kind of my final message to folks is, you know, what is your purpose? What do you want to do? Why do you want to make things? And that may change, you know, over time, and that's fine too. But it can't just be about proving yourself, because that's kind of a bit of a dead end, you know. It's really a journey, and I think the more you can share that with other people, the more enriching it will be.
Great words to end on. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
My pleasure. Yeah, it's been really fun. Thank you so much, Margaret.